I'm going to invite you to open your Bible to the book of 1 Corinthians, and we're going to take our lesson from 1 Corinthians chapter 1 today. Paul wrote the first letter to the Corinthians to address certain problems in the church at Corinth. Some of the problems that Paul addressed were problems that the Corinthians had asked about. The Corinthians had evidently written Paul some kind of a letter or had corresponded with Paul in some way, and Paul spends the last part of the book, in fact, the bulk of the book, answering some of the questions that the Corinthians were asking him about marriage and about how things are to take place in worship and things like that. Other issues that Paul addresses in the book of 1 Corinthians are issues that were reported to Paul by a group of people he calls Chloe's people, whether that's Chloe's family or people associated with a disciple named Chloe is perhaps unclear. But in other words, Paul had heard some things about what was going on in Corinth, and he takes this opportunity to write this letter to address some of those problems. Now, whether Paul is answering questions or responding to various issues described by Chloe's people, this letter addresses a laundry list of issues and misunderstandings that were found in the church at Corinth. Now, several weeks ago, we began looking at chapter 1, where Paul begins addressing the first issue, and I'd like to pick up our discussion where we left off. We're going to begin in verse 18 here in just a minute. But I want to remind you about the issue that Paul is addressing here in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. If you look in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, look at verse 11. Paul frames the discussion for us. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 11, he says, "I have been informed concerning you, my brethren, by Chloe's people, that there are quarrels among you." Paul describes the fact that it has been reported that there are divisions and infighting, or maybe I should say there is infighting that might lead to divisions if left unchecked. And they need to be wary of this, and they need to be on guard that this doesn't become a bigger issue than it already is. He says, there are quarrels among you. You are fighting amongst yourselves. And Paul's instruction, of course, throughout this first couple of chapters is that it needs to stop. Well, the question I think is fair to ask, and we addressed this several weeks ago when we looked at it. What were they quarreling over? And if you look in your Bibles at verse 12, we'll get the answer to that here briefly as we continue to frame the discussion for verse 18 and beyond. Chapter 1 and verse 12, Paul says, "Now, I mean this." This is what you're fighting over. He says, "Some are saying, I am of Paul, and I of Apollos, and I of Cephas, and I of Christ." There's some division, there's some infighting, there's some struggling going on between you based on personalities, based on which teacher they preferred or which teacher they identified better with or learned better from or something. The fact is they were identifying with certain people in the early church who they identified as great, right? Why would somebody follow after Paul? Well, Paul's a well-known apostle. We think well of him. Maybe he taught me the gospel or something like that, and I feel this sort of connection to him. Why would somebody follow Cephas? That's Peter, by the way. Why would somebody follow after Peter? Well, Peter also is a great apostle. Maybe we prefer Peter's style of preaching to Paul's style of preaching or something like that. They are choosing people to identify themselves with that they thought were great. And they were choosing to identify themselves more with those men that they thought to be great than identifying themselves with the Christ who saves them. And what Paul tells them in verse 17, he says that in doing so, they make the cross of Christ void. They make it worthless. They make it of no value to them anymore. Now, these first couple of verses here, verses 10 through 17, is what we looked at a couple of weeks ago. But that's really just the beginning of Paul's discussion about these quarrels. In the next few chapters, as we go through 1 Corinthians, Paul is going to go into detail about why they should stop quarreling, why they should overcome these senseless divisions and be united together. He's going to address this issue head on. I want to just take the next couple of verses, and we'll read a little bit, and I want to make a few comments that I hope will be helpful to you as you think about the text, 1 Corinthians. So let's begin in verse 18, shall we? Verse 18, and we'll just read a couple of verses here. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 18 and 19. He continues this thought about division and quarreling. He says, "For the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside." Okay. We've got Paul making a statement about the cross of Christ. And we've got Paul making a quotation from the book of Isaiah there about wisdom and cleverness and what he's going to do to them. So let me say a few things about this before we launch into the rest of this text. First, I want to try to identify something with you. I want to ask this question. I want to ask the question, what is the cross of Christ when Paul writes that phrase here in this book? What is the cross of Christ? For the word of the cross, he says, is foolishness. Well, what is the cross? Now, Paul has already used this expression, which is why I think it's an important one. If you go back up to verse 17 where we just noticed, he said it is the cross of Christ that would be made void if they didn't stop the quarreling, if they didn't stop the bickering. So he's already talked about this cross of Christ. And he carries it into verse 18 and beyond, the cross of Christ. What is he talking about here? What I want to suggest to you to think about with me here for a minute is that Paul is not envisioning when he says that you're going to make the cross of Christ void, or when he talks about the word of the cross, he's not talking or he's not envisioning that wooden structure that Jesus died on, right? He doesn't have in his mind like, you know, if y'all don't stop fighting, that cross that we keep in the back room that, you know, where Jesus died, that's going to somehow become void, right? No, he's not talking about the physical wooden beams, okay? That's what I'm trying to get you to see. He's not talking about the physical wooden structure that Jesus hung on when he died. Paul rather is invoking the image of the cross to represent Jesus' sacrifice and the whole gospel message that goes with it. When Paul says that you're going to make the cross of Christ void, what he's talking about is not the wooden structure. He's talking about the gospel that comes with it. He's talking about the sacrifice that Jesus made and everything that it means to Christians. If you don't stop bickering, it's all for naught, is what he's saying. The gospel, the good news. This is why Paul can talk about in verse 18, the word of the cross, right? It's not like the cross is speaking words, literally like the wooden structure is speaking words. He's talking about the message that comes with the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. So Paul's using a figure of speech here, and I want to be clear about this. Paul is using a figure of speech here to describe the whole gospel message when he says the cross of Christ or the word of the cross. This is the good news that Jesus' death on the cross represents. And Paul looks at this cross now, and he says the word of the cross, he's going to point out a few things about this to us. He's going to point out a few things about the gospel to us. Let me share these with you here. The first thing that he points out to us is this. Everything about the cross, everything about the death of Jesus and the gospel that it represents, everything about the cross appears to be foolishness from a worldly or a human perspective. If you stumbled upon somebody teaching this message about the cross of Jesus Christ, and you knew nothing about God or about Jesus, if you were, uninitiated, I suppose, for lack of a better term, if you didn't know the lingo, if you didn't know the story, somebody just told you this story about a guy. In fact, this isn't just a guy. He's God in heaven. And he comes down to earth, and he says, I'm going to establish a kingdom, and then he dies. Right? That's not the kind of story that we would typically gravitate to. From a worldly and human perspective, that's not a very good story. That God would come to earth with a great promise to save the world, but die at the hands of the Romans without ever establishing any kind of worldly kingdom. He doesn't topple the great structures that he said he was going to topple, at least in any kind of physical, observable way. This isn't the kind of story that the world would look at and identify as something great. In fact, what I want you to see, we have hero stories in our own culture, right? Marvel, right? Y'all watch Marvel movies. Those are our hero stories. Even those deaths appear to us from a worldly perspective to be better than the death at the cross. And here's what I mean by that. Our heroes sometimes die in our stories, right? Iron Man, I think, right? Died. Spoiler alert, maybe I shouldn't have said that. I think it's been long enough. Iron Man dies in the story, right? But why does Iron Man die? For those of you who've seen Marvel movies, some of you don't have any idea what I'm talking about, and that's okay. I'll tell you. Iron Man dies in a great heroic act of selflessness. He dies in the midst of a great battle. He dies fighting for his people, for his friends, for his loved ones. That's why Iron Man dies. Jesus died on a Roman cross. Do you know what a Roman cross was? That's not the heroic kind of death that we would ascribe to our heroes. The Roman cross was the most humiliating death that anyone in the first century could have gone through. It was reserved for the worst of the worst. This is not the idea of a heroic death at all. This is not the idea that we would paint a picture of. If we were trying to paint a portrait of a perfect hero, of someone who was great. In fact, we often focus, when we talk about the cross of Christ, we very often focus on the pain associated with the cross. The cross was painful. I don't want to limit that at all. But the cross was far more shameful than it was painful. The cross brought far more shame than it did pain. It was a shameful death. It wasn't a great heroic death from a worldly perspective. From a worldly perspective, it's foolishness. Who would believe this story? And if you believe it, who would follow it? From a worldly perspective, we look at the story of the cross, we look at the gospel message, and we see what is at face value a very, very unflattering story. And that's what Paul says here in the text, isn't it? The word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. It's foolishness. It doesn't look like the kind of thing we would go after. But the cross is more powerful than we can begin to imagine. It is foolishness to those who are perishing, verse 18, but to those who are being saved, it is the power of God. Paul looks at this cross, this unflattering story of a man who dies the most shameful death known of the day at the day, and he says, this is the power of God. This is how he brings salvation into the world. In Jesus' shameful death, he proved himself victorious over both shame and death. In the cross, Jesus won salvation for all who would be faithful to him. And so what Paul presents here and what he's trying to get us to see is that the cross, the gospel, the thing that we are uniting ourselves under is really rather counterintuitive. It's not what we would think it would be. And so Paul quotes from Isaiah chapter 29 and verse 14. There in verse 19, he quotes from Isaiah 29:14. In the cross, in the gospel, God turns everything upside down on its head. Everything. I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside. If there is a wise man, the cross of Christ proves him to be foolish. If there is a clever man in the world, the cross of the Christ proves him not to be as clever as he thinks. Those who appear to be wise to you and to me, people we might look to and acknowledge as something great in the world, the Pauls of the world, the Apollos's of the world, the Peters of the world, we look at those men and we say, those are something special. Paul and Apollos and Peter and you know, those are people that really know their stuff. They're something special. They're wise. They're clever. They might be clever. But those who appear to be wise to you and me, what Paul says is they are nothing when compared to the cross of Christ. So the gospel is this strange enigma. It's a counterintuitive story. It's a counterintuitive statement and symbol for salvation. Now, Paul's going to play with that idea here about foolishness and wisdom. and about what truly makes one foolish and wise. Keep reading in the text with me. Let's go on a little bit further here. Look at verse 20. He says, where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness to the through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For indeed, Jews ask for signs and Greeks search for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block and to Gentiles foolishness. But to those who are the called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Paul asks a series of rhetorical questions. He likes to do this, especially when he's trying to combat issues in churches. He'll ask rhetorical questions. He says, where is the wisest person you can find? Go find your scribes, Jews. Go find your debaters, Gentiles. You round up the smartest people you can find. You go out and you find them and you bring them here. I wonder if we did that, who that would look like. Who would we find if we went out and tried to identify the smartest people we knew? Maybe you know some pretty smart people in your life. Maybe you have some kind of a college professor in mind, some great doctor that you go to, some brilliant scientist you see on TV, and you say, well, they really know their stuff. They're smart. They are bright. They're great debaters. They're great wise men, or whatever the case may be. Look at what Paul says in verse 20. Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? Even the smartest, brightest person in the world, when compared to God and His gospel, when looked at in light of the cross, is nothing. Doesn't matter how many degrees they have hanging on their wall. Doesn't matter how much life experience they have. Doesn't matter how bright they are, how smart they are, how good they are at getting their point across. Even the smartest man in the world, when compared to God and His gospel, is nothing. The reality is, and what Paul is trying to get these Christians to understand here in 1 Corinthians, is that it doesn't matter who you are, no one is smart compared to God. In fact, Paul goes on to say that God has chosen a supposedly foolish message. He's chosen the cross to bring about salvation. Just to make his point abundantly clear, God chose a message that those who are wisest and those who are smartest and those who are cleverest, most clever, those people would most likely reject. In fact, if you go and talk to the brightest scientist in the world, he will likely tell you that the gospel story, that is to say Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, if you go ask the brightest scientist in the world, he's probably going to tell you that's a fairy tale. He's going to tell you that is foolishness. You can't believe that message. And yet it's exactly that story that God used to bring the offer of salvation into the world. Friends, that's significant because the gospel doesn't draw people to itself when they have a sophisticated or an academic understanding of it or the world around them. That's not what makes the gospel attractive. What makes the gospel attractive, what makes the gospel draw people to itself is its simplicity. That is a foolish story. And it's because it's a foolish story that people are attracted to it. Everybody who comes to the gospel seems to want to put it through some kind of a test. And Paul alludes to this. He says, well, the Jews want signs, right? The Jews come to the gospel, they come to the cross, and they say, we'll believe it if you show us signs. Greeks come to the gospel and they say, we'll believe it if you give us wisdom, if you give us reason to believe it. Jews ask for signs, Greeks search for wisdom, verse 22. But the gospel doesn't pass that test. And by the way, you try to put the gospel through your test, through your worldview, and it probably won't fit there either. Not until you make the gospel worldview your worldview. The gospel won't pass your test. What is it that you want the gospel to do for you? Bring you signs or wisdom? Bring you happiness or health or wealth or socialization or whatever it is? It's not going to pass that test because from a worldly perspective, as long as you're trying to extract worldly things from the gospel, it's not going to work. because it's foolishness to the world. Look at verse 23 and 24. Paul says, "But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ crucified is the power of God and the wisdom of God." The gospel doesn't always provide what we think it should. It doesn't always look like we think it should, but it is powerful. The cross is powerful. There is no amount of wisdom in the world that can comprehend the message, because the foolishness of God is stronger than men. The foolishness of God is stronger than men. Have you ever thought about that statement? If it's not in poor taste to say it this way, and I don't think it is, but I hope you understand what I'm trying to say here. If God ever had a foolish moment, if you could ever look at anything God did and said, that was foolish of God to do that, and I don't think you can say that, but if you could, that moment would still far surpass in wisdom the greatest wisdom that man has to offer. The foolishness of God is stronger than men. Truly, what we think is foolish is great power and wisdom to God. I want to end here, verses 26 through 31. We'll read the text here. But I'm going to give you a little snippet here before we jump into that. What I want you to see is that Paul's making this point about foolishness and wisdom, what it truly means to be foolish and what it truly means to be wise. And at the end of this reading that we're going to do here today, this isn't the end of Paul's discussion, but the end of our reading here today, down to the end of the chapter, what I want you to see is that Paul's going to give us a reality check. He's going to help us see the way we really need to look at ourselves in relationship to the gospel around us. Look at verse 26. "For consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong, and the base things of the world and the despised God has chosen, the things that are not, so that he may nullify the things that are, so that no man may boast before God. But by his doing, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God and righteousness and sanctification and redemption. So that just as it is written, let him who boasts, boast in the Lord." There's a reality check here. And here comes the really hard part for us, at least in terms of this lesson. Because Paul is now, he's not talking about abstractly what the Jews and the Gentiles are doing. They're looking for signs and wisdom, and God has silenced the wisdom of the world and all of that kind of stuff. He's not talking about external things anymore. He's now calling us to look inwardly. "Consider your calling, brethren." Not many of the Corinthians were wise. Not many of the Corinthians were noble. Not many of the Corinthians were mighty. Here's what he's saying. Corinthians, you're not that special. You're not that great. You don't fit the bill to even be on the top kind of tier in the world around you. And can I, please don't hate me after this. Can I give us a quick reality check? We're not that special. You start looking around this room, there are a lot of bright people in this room. A lot of wonderful people, a lot of caring and loving and wise people in this room. But you even start looking around this room and you think about how the world would look on us, the people in this room. Are any of us in like the top echelon of people as the world would see it? Hardly. The world doesn't look kindly on us. Because from a worldly perspective, we're nothing great. We're not mighty. We're not wise. Many of us are not what the world would call successful or bright. We're not that great. But this is Paul's whole point about the gospel. The gospel doesn't attract those who are wise by the world's standards. It doesn't. It attracts those who are wise by God's standards. And God chose us, Weak and foolish as we are, He chose us to show His great wisdom and power. And it is to the world's shame that the wisest and strongest people the world has to offer reject the greatest gift that ever has been offered. So I think I can summarize Paul's point here like this. There is nothing happening here among this group of people. There is nothing happening here that gives you or me any right to boast because we're nothing special. There's nothing that gives us a right to boast in ourselves or to boast in anything that's going on around us. We're not here because we're wise. We're not here because we cracked the code and we figured out the gospel and nobody else could do it. That's not what's happening here. We're here because of what God has done. We're here because we serve a wise and a powerful God. And it is God's wisdom and power that has brought salvation. Without God, we are nothing. All of this is done, and I'm going to ask you to look at verse 29 here as we kind of wrap this up a little bit. All of this is done so that no man may boast before God. You see that? That's why it's important that we understand that we're not that great. So that we don't come to think in our own mind that we have done something special or that we have accumulated something for ourselves that is not ours. It is not for us to take that boast upon ourselves. Any boasting that we do needs to be boasting in the Lord. Verse 31. Paul has said an awful lot in this reading that we've done. Verses 18 through 31. He's done an awful lot. He said an awful lot about the cross of Christ. He said an awful lot about foolishness and wisdom and boasting. But remember, Paul's talking about quarrels, right? That's where we started back in verse 11, 10 and 11. He says, I hear that there are divisions among you, and I've heard from Chloe's people that there are actually these quarrels. You're fighting with one another, and you're dividing yourselves based on your preference of teacher. You remember the text? Verse 12? I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, I'm of Cephas. What's happening here? And why is Paul talking about the cross of Christ and foolishness and wisdom and boasting? I think maybe one of two things, or maybe both of these things are happening here. When the Corinthians go around and they say, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, I'm of Cephas, or I'm of Christ, they are first boasting in their own abilities to pick the best teacher. You ever heard people like that? Like, I follow this guy's teaching, or I read this guy's books, and if you just understood, you would like his teaching too. That's really a boast in ourselves. That we have the right way of looking at this, that we have attained this on our own or something like that. I am of Paul, and you should be too. The second thing that they're doing, though, is boasting in the teacher that they're following. I am of Paul. He's someone great, right? I am of Apollos. I am of Cephas. They're looking to these men as some great source of wisdom, as some great source of power, and they're identifying themselves with them. You want to know how the Corinthians could have avoided a lot of these quarrels? I wonder how they could have avoided a lot of the divisions that they were facing. If the Corinthians had wrapped their minds around the fact that the gospel was not about them, a lot of these quarrels would have been defunct. It wouldn't have been there. It wouldn't have happened. If they had recognized that the gospel was not about them and how great they were and about the great choices that they made and the teachers that they followed, and if they had recognized that the gospel was all about Jesus Christ and His glory, they wouldn't have been splintered off in different factions based on the different teachers that they preferred. They would have had a singular focus on the one Christ who saved them and brought them together under the cross of Christ. It's hard to be divided when you have a singular mind on what's most important. And that's what Paul is trying to get them to see. The gospel is not about Paul. The gospel is not about Peter. The gospel is not about you or me. It is all about Jesus and His glory. So, if you want to avoid quarreling, and if you want to maintain unity in this church, like the Corinthians were called to do, do not boast in yourself. Chapter 1, verse 29. Don't boast in yourself. Don't revel in your own accomplishments. Don't presume that you are wiser than those around you. Don't presume that you have the answers and nobody else does. Don't look down on others for their supposed inferiority. Don't boast in yourself because it's not about you. It's not about me. And don't boast in others, other people. Whoever you admire, whoever that may be, don't exalt them above where they belong. Don't attach yourself to or identify yourself by any leader or teacher save the Christ. Peace and unity will come in the church when we all realize that only God is wise. And when we all boast in God, we will all be focused in the same direction. And that's the hope. And I think that's what Paul calls the Corinthians to do. Stop splintering yourself off and join your focus on the cross of Christ. Foolish as it may seem to the world, it is the power of God for our salvation. Can I help you today come to know Christ? Can we pray with you and encourage you to be united with us in the gospel? If there's anything that we can do to help you with that, we would love to have an opportunity to sit down and talk with you, to study with you, to help you come to Christ this day. If there's anything that we can do for you right now of a spiritual nature, if you need encouragement or if you need prayers or whatever the case is, you are welcome to come and make those needs known to us as we stand and as we sing a song of encouragement.